With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning. Today is Monday, July 31st. Summer is going so quickly. Coming up in today's show, drought is affecting many crops around the nation. We have an update and how it could affect consumers here. But first, we're starting this morning with Brian German.
Growers from the southern U.S. spent last week touring California farms as part of the National Cotton Council's Producer Information Exchange. Roger Isom, president and CEO of the California Cotton Ginners and Growers Association, talked about the value of the program.
I think is a valuable experience, not just for the growers here that go back east and see what other growers are doing, but growers come out here to California. We kick off the tour with an overview of issues that California cotton growers are facing, whether it's air quality or water quality, just the regulatory pressures we're facing here. I think gives them a perspective that they just don't see.
California cotton growers overcome a lot of obstacles that growers in other areas don't have to deal with.
It takes a very resilient grower to stay in business in California and stay ahead of the curve. They see that. They learn a little bit about that. They spend the 3 or 4 days out here touring the farms and processing facilities to see just how we do it. It's one thing to talk about it, but how do you actually do it? And so they get to see some of that, and hopefully some of that goes back with them.
I'm Brian German for Agnet West.
The Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers will formally propose to withdraw the Waters of the U.S. rule, a controversial Obama-era rule on clean water. This move will mark the end of years of efforts by farm groups to get rid of something they called a burdensome federal overreach. The proposed rule to withdraw WOTUS was first revealed back in June, but it hadn't been noticed in the Federal Register. The formal step kicks off a 30-day public comment period. Critics of the withdrawal have called for more time to weigh in on the matter. The proposed rule to withdraw WOTUS won't have much of a noticeable effect out in the countryside. WOTUS was only in effect for a short time before the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals put it on hold. The repeal rule is seen as a possible safety net in the event that the U.S. Supreme Court determines that the Court of Appeals did not have the jurisdiction over the case and lifts the hold. While the repeal rule keeps the status quo, the Trump administration will work on its own plan to decide which waters are subject to federal regulation and should reveal that plan in December. Giving testimony to the House subcommittees on environment and energy, Growth Energy CEO Emily Score told lawmakers that ethanol use in fuels benefits farmers and consumers alike.
Ethanol is an oxygenate. It's a high-octane fuel, and so it allows the fuel to burn more completely and more efficiently. That is key to fuel efficiency. And as we are looking for the engine of the future that has to meet more stringent CAFE standards, ethanol is going to be key to that solution. And the other benefits of higher blends of ethanol are environmental and human health. As you have higher blends of ethanol, you're going to continue to reduce greenhouse gases. And on the human health side, ethanol replaces toxic carcinogenic additives like benzene. And so the result is the tailpipe emissions are cleaner. The air that we're breathing is cleaner as well.
The hearing was titled Examining Advancements in Biofuels, Balancing Federal Research and Market Innovation. As part of her comments to lawmakers, Score says that securing the Reed vapor pressure waiver to allow for E15 sales year-round across the nation is a critical step in helping to advance ethanol.
That's really key to helping fulfill the promise of the renewable fuel standard and the promise of more biofuels in our transportation fuel mix. There is a bill in Congress that's got bipartisan support, and so we're moving that through the process. And there's also been conversations with EPA in terms of what they could do to be helpful as well. So all parties in the biofuel supply chain are recognizing the pivotal importance of securing this waiver, because that really will help drive further market access for consumers and further consumer demand for the fuel.
While questioned by lawmakers how ethanol production impacts food prices, Score cited data that shows no connection between the two.
The UN has a food price index, and they look at the price of cereal, grain-based cereal. The price of cereal is lower today than it was in 2007 when we expanded the renewable fuel standard. If you open the newspaper and you read the latest Wall Street Journal story on food prices in the U.S., we are experiencing a record all-time low stretch in terms of food prices. So really, the data out there continue to reinforce that there is no correlation. To the extent that food prices are a function of anything, it actually is a function of oil prices.
She says the hearing offered a great opportunity to highlight the benefits of biofuels research.
It was a lively conversation. I was very thankful to have the opportunity to testify, because at the end of the day, as we strive toward energy security, energy innovation, energy diversity, all of those goals require investment by both public and private sector, investment in many different ways. And so I was pleased to be able to talk about the extent to which private sector and consumers across the country have benefited from the federal government's support of and investment in continued research of biofuels and continuing to reinforce the importance of consumers being able to access these biofuels.
That's Growth Energy CEO Emily Score. The latest drought monitor shows soils continuing to dry out and crops suffering as drought and abnormal dryness expands and intensifies across the Plains, Midwest, Northern Rockies, and Virginia. Montana saw the most severe level of drought, called the exceptional drought, which grew by 10 points in a week in that state. 12% of that state is in exceptional drought and 24% is under extreme conditions. In neighboring North Dakota, 8% of the state is in exceptional drought. Another 30% is in extreme drought. In the Corn Belt, drought conditions have shown up in Iowa. The state's moderate drought grew to 34%. All states east of the Mississippi River are drought-free now, but patches of abnormal dryness mean it could change as early as next week. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says drought conditions are intensifying across the central United States. The Corn Belt has seen double-digit percentage increases. Drought coverage is growing around the nation, with the current drought monitor showing more than 32% of the country in some form of drought. Retail beef prices are already below last year, but a drought-induced sell-off of cattle could mean even more downward pressure on beef prices in a few months. Gary Crawford continues our coverage of the nation's drought.
The drought in the Northern Plains is making life not so pleasant for cattle producers with little or no forage to feed their animals, but for consumers, it could bring on some lower beef prices toward the end of this year and into next. With pastures dried up, many Northern Plains cattle producers are having to sell off more than the usual number of their animals to feedlots. Feedlots take cattle, feed them grain, sell them to meat processors. Agriculture Department livestock analyst Shale Shagham says in a few months, when beef from this surge of cattle hits the stores,
we do expect with increased supplies of beef to have downward pressure on retail beef prices, and we would expect to see in 2017 the CPI for beef to probably decline around 2%.
This would be 2 years in a row now that the consumer price index for beef will have declined. Last year, retail beef prices fell over 6%. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Attention, California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. The 26th annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida is proud to host U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sunny Perdue on August 16th, the first day of the show. Make plans now to attend the 26th annual Citrus Expo on August 16th and 17th for an opportunity to mingle with Secretary Perdue on the trade show floor. The latest in citrus research and data will also be presented at over a dozen seminars. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and that the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
What's happening below the surface can mean success or failure for your crops. New MycoApply Endomax from Valent USA Corporation is the latest innovation to help take your tree nut, tree fruit, vine, and vegetable crops to the next level. Mycoapply Indomax contains a unique blend of four mycorrhizal fungi that colonizes a plant's roots to create a symbiotic root and mycelial network. Where water is limited, this enhanced network improves plant vigor by expanding the root's ability to efficiently absorb water and nutrients under variable environmental conditions. Ultimately, Mycoapply Indomax helps deliver consistent plant health and overall performance to optimize yield. Plus, Mycoapply Indomax is OMRI listed for organic production. Maximize your crop's potential with new Mycoapply Indomax from Valent. For more information, contact your PCA or visit valent.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's Taylor Hillman.
A fairly new pest to California is starting to concern researchers in the southern end of the state.
So the weevil that we're dealing with now is the South American palm weevil, and obviously it's not native to California. Its native range includes parts of Mexico, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean.
UC Riverside entomology specialist Mark Hoddle said the relatively large weevil continues to spread from the Mexican border, and urbanization has likely helped.
I think in large part because of how humans have modified the desert habitat, and that's through creating urban tracts that become heavily irrigated, and then those urban landscapes end up with palm trees. So human activity has probably helped this weevil spread from, you know, tropical forests where there's lots of rain and palm trees into desert areas where it would never have been able to survive because there were no palms there, certainly not in the densities at which palm trees are present now. So humans have created this ideal environment throughout these desert areas by urbanization, planting palm trees, and keeping them really well irrigated.
Stay with AgNet West to hear about another way we might be aiding in the spread of this pest. I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, it was announced late last week by the government of Japan that rising imports of frozen beef in the first quarter of the Japanese fiscal year, which was April through June, have triggered a safeguard resulting in an automatic increase to Japan's tariff rate under the WTO on imports of frozen beef from the U.S. The increase from 38.5% to 50% will begin August 1st and last through March 31 of next year. The tariff would affect only exporters from countries, including the U.S., who do not have free trade agreements with Japan currently in force. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue issued a statement saying, "I am concerned that an increase in Japan's tariff on frozen beef imports will impede U.S. beef sales and is likely to increase the U.S. overall trade deficit with Japan. This would harm our important bilateral trade relationship with Japan on ag products. It would also negatively affect Japanese consumers by raising prices and limiting their access to high-quality U.S. frozen beef." Perdue said, "I have asked representatives of the Japanese government directly and clearly to make every effort to address these strong concerns and the harm that could result to both American producers and Japanese consumers." U.S. exports of beef and beef products to Japan totaled $1.5 billion last year, making it the U.S. top market. In a release from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, their president, Craig Uden, issued a statement saying, "We're very disappointed to learn that this tariff will increase from 38.5% to 50%. Japan is the top export market for U.S. beef in both volume and value, and anything that restricts our sales to that country will have a negative impact on America's ranching families and our Japanese consumers." Uden said, "Our producers lose access, and beef becomes a lot more expensive for Japanese consumers, so we hope the Trump administration and Congress realize this unfortunate development underscores the urgent need for a bilateral trade agreement with Japan, absent the Trans-Pacific Partnership." And the Northern Plains drought continues to force cattle producers in that area of the country into making some tough choices. With more on that story, here's Gary Crawford.
You've probably heard the number. 75% of the pastures and rangelands in North Dakota rated in poor to very poor shape. South Dakota, 73%. Montana, 56%. And all these numbers expected to increase. Agriculture Department livestock analyst Shale Shackham says as forage conditions worsen,
producers are going to be faced with a harder decision about whether to retain some of their existing heifers for the breeding herd or whether to put them plus any other animals into the feedlots. If you simply don't have the forage, you can't maintain them. You either sell them to people who do have grass, or you put them in the feedlots.
Feedlots seem to be getting the lion's share right now. Back in June, feedlot placements in South Dakota, for example, were up from last year by 67%. Shagham says so far, feedlots have managed to stay profitable, and so at least for now,
they seem to be willing to pay to get their hands on those calves.
2 weeks ago, USDA was forecasting U.S. beef production this year to be up 5%, next year up 2%. Shagham says, considering what's going on, analysts will revisit those forecasts in USDA's next monthly supply and demand report coming August 10th. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Thanks, Gary, and I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
Well, coyotes are making news again. My last report dealt with a growing problem in our larger Midwestern cities. This one is out of the Southeast region. No telling where the next one will be from, because the once-noted creature from the West is a growing problem everywhere. But the present problem is in the South. Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama primarily. One county in Louisiana reported 160 coyotes killed in a single month. They're especially a problem for people who own small animals. Now, that includes cats, dogs, chickens, especially chickens, and they're beginning to affect wildlife. Squirrels, rabbits, raccoons, possums. Most of the coyotes killed were killed by hunting club members. That's men with guns. I'll tell you this, though. Men with guns is not the solution to the coyote problem. Never will be. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Griner, AgNet West.
Kelly Marshall has today's interview segment. Here's the interview.
This is Kelly Marshall at Info Ag in St. Louis, Missouri, and I'm here with our keynote speaker for the opening plenary session. This is Steve Sonka. Steve, would you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Hi. I am an emeritus professor in agricultural strategy from the University of Illinois. I'm an economist who spent my life thinking about the food industry and the ag industry, and particularly how information technology is changing it. I continue to work in that area because it's just so exciting and there are so many opportunities.
Now, you were here at this conference 3 years ago, and we were able at AgWire to interview you then. What has changed in the 3 years since you presented?
So 3 years ago, my talk was entitled Big Data. If it's the answer, what are the questions? And I think we've moved beyond sort of big data as it's really precisely understood. Big data is really, really important. We use it all the time as we drive our cars around. But big data is only part of the opportunity in agriculture, production agriculture. And so I talked today about digital ag, and what that refers to is the introduction, really, in the last 4 or 5 years, of new sensors, new devices to capture data about actual production on our farms, in our fields and feedlots and pens. We've never had that before. And that raises lots of opportunities that really go beyond big data as we normally think of it.
Now, you also talked, in addition to big data, about this idea of lots of data, which was kind of a new concept for me. Can you break that down for us just a little bit?
Okay, and maybe it's a bit of semantics, but I think it's really important. Big data is what we look to Google, what we look to multinational corporations, large organizations, because you have to be large to amass data that's terabytes and terabytes, and to have data scientists with PhDs to do analytics. Very important, and we're doing that. But in agriculture, we're seeing lots of data being collected at the level of the individual farm. So it's all those USB drives that farmers have in their desk drawer. And they looked at a map, and they gained some insights. But if you could take the data from 3 or 4 years of those, combine them, do some more sophisticated analytics, there are insights there for that farm operator without having to pool their data. And what's really kind of changed is that we have data, we have tools now, softwares that would kind of think of Excel on steroids, that would allow farmers and their consultants to really gain insights from the data they have in their desk drawer. And I refer to that as lots of data because it isn't the massive size of true big data, but it's bigger than what I could do with my own knowledge of an Excel sheet. It's just too much for one Excel sheet. So there's a gap there that I think is a real opportunity for entrepreneurs to service, but then for making farmers more effective.
You also talked about the economics behind the big data and the lots of data and being able to use the technology that's being developed. And here at InfoAg, we have a lot of people who are developing that technology. So can you talk a little bit about where new and bigger and brighter meets the pavement and somebody paying for this to happen.
So there's an interesting thing about the economics of data and digital data. So if I have an ice cream cone and I give it to you and you eat it, I'm sad, you're happy because you consumed it. I couldn't, unless we shared, of course. Data, I can give you my USB drive, and you have a copy of data, and I have a copy of data. What that fundamentally changes is, historically, there was value in capturing data and holding it close to you as an organization. Today, the value is in capturing the data, interpreting it, and helping your customer or helping yourself, if you're a farmer, gain value from using the data. So the value isn't in holding the data close. The value is in, if you will, the services that can be provided, whether you're doing it for yourself or whether you're a consultant working with farmers or a co-op working with farmers. Really difficult. It's a lot easier to say that than it is really to do it. It's hard because other people get the data, and the competition then is not who has the data. The competition is who's adding value. And that's good for the customer, but it's hard for the provider.
Well, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with me. We'll hopefully see you back at InfoAg in a few more years, and we'll see what's new and different and changed since then.
Thank you very much.
This is Kelly Marshall at InfoAg.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Attention, California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. The 26th annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida is proud to host U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sunny Perdue on August 16th, the first day of the show. Make plans now to attend the 26th annual Citrus Expo on August 16th and 17th for an opportunity to mingle with Secretary Perdue on the trade show floor. The latest in citrus research and data will also be presented at over a dozen seminars. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net.
What's happening below the surface can mean success or failure for your crops. New MycoApply Endomax from Valent USA Corporation is the latest innovation to help take your tree nut, tree fruit, vine, and vegetable crops to the next level. MycoApply Endomax contains a unique blend of four mycorrhizal fungi that colonizes a plant's roots to create a symbiotic root and mycelial network. Where water is limited, this enhanced network improves plant vigor by expanding the root's ability to efficiently absorb water and nutrients under variable environmental conditions. Ultimately, MycoApply Endomax helps deliver consistent plant health and overall performance to optimize yield. Plus, MycoApply Endomax is OMRI listed for organic production. Maximize your crop's potential with new MycoApply Endomax from Valent. For more information, contact your PCA or visit valent.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Your Beef Checkoff does all kinds of things to help make sure consumers feel good about buying beef, like researching the health benefits of beef and sharing this news with healthcare professionals. Or discovering new lean cuts of beef like the Denver cut steak, which fits an active lifestyle. Or sharing the good news about these new beef products and cuts with chefs, grocers, and consumers. Get to know your checkoff and start sharing your views at mybeefcheckoff.com. Paid for by the Beef Checkoff.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. Now more of the agriculture stories you'll want to know today. Rollover protective structures found on many farm tractors these days play an important role in keeping operators safe. Here's Rod Bain with more.
The National Safety Council says the leading cause of farm operator deaths since 1970 is tractor rollovers. Now, 5 years earlier, tractor manufacturers produced the first models with rollover protective structures, ROPs. Chuck Schwab of Iowa State University Extension says this started out as anti-roll bars designed to prevent death and minimize injury in the event of a rollover.
On some of the older tractors, probably some of the ones, especially without the cabs, you'll still see the bar, and whether it's a two-post or a four-post, and it provides that protective environment.
However, many pre-1985 tractors do not have rollover protective structures. It wasn't until that year that tractor manufacturers adopted a voluntary standard to include ROPS technology going forward.
Meaning that whenever you got a new tractor, it had it in it. It was a part of the structure. And that's where you see a big change is in 85, as all the tractors since then all have the protective structure in place.
In fact,
most of your modern tractors tractor have a environmental cab. All the new ones have ROPS integrated into that nice cab. So you no longer see this large bar that protects an individual. It's a part of that structure.
Now, what about some of those pre-1985 tractor models that don't have some form of rollover protective structure? Can those be retrofitted? Schwab explains.
Some of those can never have ROPS because of the way they were made. There's some that can have ROPS retrofitted on those.
Although retrofitting could cost more for an older tractor compared to its actual value. And no, an operator can't just add or install a ROPS, like a roll bar on the tractor axle, on pre-1985 tractors. Schwab notes tractor manufacturers conduct extensive static and dynamic crush tests on rollover protective structures to assure they are doing their job. So if you wonder what these two are doing these days...
Christ from East, Vince and Larry!
Vince, look out!
And that's where seat belts come in play. If you're not strapped into that seat and you don't stay in that seat, then the ROPS may not protect you at all.
That's great advice, Chuck Schwab, along with...
If you're operating in dangerous conditions on slopes and hills where overturns typically occur, then by all means, use a tractor with ROPS. Don't use a tractor without ROPS.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Bees may not be as mild-mannered and nonchalant as they seem. In this week's Agriculture USA, Stephanie Ho looks into the cutthroat world of honeybee queen succession.
Bees are always busy, which might fool you into thinking they're mild-mannered creatures. For example, they do work hard to raise their young.
When they're completely defenseless as a larva, so developing up as a grub after the eggs hatch will take about 2 weeks. And then obviously they can't control their fates much at that point.
So nice, right?
When they come out as an adult, they can battle the current queen. The queens have been known to sting each other and actually really battle it out.
Wait a minute, what?
Yeah, it's Game of Thrones when there's a queen replacement.
It turns out that bee relationships are especially fraught between the queen bee mother and her daughter, who is set up to supplant her. This is Stephanie Ho, and in this week's Agriculture USA, we'll look at the intricacies of honeybee dynamics. Popular culture is full of references of mothers wanting to get rid of their daughters. In Disney's Snow White, the wicked stepmother queen delivers a dreadful order.
Take her far into the forest. Find some secluded glade where she can pick wildflowers.
Yes, Your Majesty.
And there, my faithful huntsman, you will kill her.
In that movie, the issue was beauty. But as USDA's top bee researcher Jay Evans puts it, with honeybees, it's all about power.
And if the current queen is still in the hive, she can actually go and mark those developing queens or engage them directly and kill them off. So there is a battle in some cases for who will run the hive in the future.
Evans knows what he's talking about because he studies bees out at USDA's Bee Research Lab.
And these guys swarming around, are they upset, or are they just,
no, they're just
coming and going?
Yeah, they're just super, they're finding something.
On a recent visit, I was lucky enough to catch a swarm.
Thousands of bees will go as a group with the queen, and they'll wait until they identify a really good new home site. And when they find that home site, they'll move into a hollow tree or maybe another bee box if a beekeeper is around and start fresh with a new colony.
A swarm forms when there are two queens in the hive.
And they just tolerate each other just long enough to form that swarm and then go off to start the new hive. So they make sure they have the second queen present, and then they will go off, and the older queen will actually go off with half of the workers to try to find a new home.
In other words...
Yep, the older queen gets kicked out, and the daughter inherits the hive.
The time of year a swarm sets out will affect its chances of survival.
For them to make it through the next winter is less than 50% success rate, but it's, Gosh, it depends on the area and the time of year of those swarms. If they do it early enough, it's probably pushing 50% that they will actually establish, find a really good home, and set themselves up for the next year.
It is harder for the older queen to leave behind a good home, but there are natural reasons why it's supposed to happen that way.
Maybe she's 2 years old and that's nearing the end of her reproductive life, or by starting off on the riskier avenue, she could actually, you know, establish a hive and then be replaced by one of her daughters fairly soon too in that new place. So I think the evolutionary idea is that those older queens, they're less valuable to the hive than the brand new ones, so they're more likely to take a risk of that sort.
And it is always possible that the queen may not accept her fate.
If the old queen is not quite ready to go, and it's not the time when they're making a swarm where she has workers to go with, she can actively kill her daughters to keep from being replaced as the queen.
Which is how life in a beehive starts to resemble scenes from Game of Thrones. For example, when the queen Cersei threatened her daughter-in-law, Margaery.
If you ever call me sister again, I'll have you strangled in your sleep.
In the bee world, worker bees play an active role in managing the battles.
Every once in a while, either in preparation for a swarm or maybe if she's starting to not lay quite as many eggs, the worker bees in the hive will decide to make some of her offspring into queens, into new queens. So they might pick a handful of eggs and young larvae and raise those up as queens. So they build a little bit bigger cell or structure for those eggs, and then they feed them a special food, royal jelly, for the rest of development.
Evans points out that workers can be deciders and may even kill off one or the other of the queens. He says they also hedge their bets by initially grooming more than one successor, just to be on the safe side. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.